Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm producer Faye Adebita. Coming up on the podcast, The Enduring Power of Jane Austen. We invite a panel of acclaimed writers to discuss how the author's seven novels have shaped literature for over two centuries. This recording is an Intelligence Squared event in partnership with Sotheby's, which took place at Sotheby's in London. Our guests coming up include Helen Fielding, creator of the Bridget Jones novels and films, and Jill Hornby, author of the bestseller Miss Austen. They'll be joining Sotheby's book specialist Kanika Sands and novelist Kate Moss. It's a stellar lineup, and they all had a lot to say. Now let's join our chair for this event, the novelist and writer Kate Moss.
Well, hello everybody. How wonderful to see so many people here. I'm Kate Moss. I'm a novelist, playwright, and writer of history. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to this talk at Sotheby's in London, which is in partnership with Intelligence Squared and is part of Sotheby's Book Week, which is a series of sales this month in London, in Paris and New York, and looking at literature, illustration and musical manuscripts. And they cover every continent and every topic. And they're wonderful. Now, today, we're going to be talking about Jane Austen. Who else? Now, Jane Austen, you will probably all know, was born in 1775. She died in 1817 when she was only 41. And although there are juvenilia and there are some unfinished novels, her enormous reputation in a way is based on only six works of fiction, which is incredible. And she has continued to have an enormous influence on writers of all different genres ever since then. You know, there are two grandes dames, I suppose, of literature, both sadly no longer with us. Faye Weldon, back in 1984, wrote in Letters to Alice that she was actually a gentle writer. You should not be misled. And Hilary Mantel, in 1998, wrote an essay called Not Everybody's Dear Jane, and talked about how she was much more subversive than sometimes she was presented. But what we're going to do today, I have contemporary literary lionesses, that's you two, who are brilliant contemporary novelists who have used Jane Austen's as an inspiration for their own fiction and in some ways non-fiction as well. And I can't wait to hear what you're going to say. And so I have with me Helen Fielding, who is the author of the multi-million selling series Bridget Jones' Diary, Bridget Jones' The Edge of Reason, Bridget Jones' Mad About the Boy, and Bridget Jones's Baby. There's a theme here. And she was also, of course, the co-writer of the Bridget Jones movies. And this wonderful piece of information, in a survey conducted by the Guardian newspaper, Bridget Jones's Diary was named as one of the 10 novels, just 10, that defined the 20th century. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, a round of applause.
Whoa, I agree. But no less literary lionessy is Jill Hornby, who is the author of four amazing novels, including the novel Miss Austen, which was a number one bestseller and named one of the best novels of 2020 by The Times and The Observer, and also Godisham Park, which was another huge bestseller in 2022, and also you've written The Hive, and Altogether Now, and a biography of Jane Austen for younger readers called The Story of Jane Austen. So another round of applause for Jill. Pippin Charles. And the final literary lioness of the panel is Kanika Sands. Kanika is the international specialist in the books and manuscripts department here at Sotheby's. She did her DPhil at Oxford, where her research focused on the intersections of British literature and the history of science and medicine. And during her time at Sotheby's, she's been involved in many important collections, including that of Barbara and Ira Littman, Dorothy Tapper Goldman, and most recently, Bibliotheca Bookorum. I knew I wasn't going to be able to say that. I nearly crossed it out. Will you say it for us, Kalika?
Bibliotheca Brookeriana.
There we are. You see, it was a hard word. Final round of applause, and then we'll get going. There you are, a woman of many, many talents. Now, we're going to talk amongst ourselves for about half an hour or so, as if you were not there. And then there will be some time for audience questions at the end. So save up your questions and leap in, because you know the time will go very, very fast, and you'll be very sad if you don't get to ask your question. Right. Icebreaker question, Helen. When did you fall in love with Jane Austen?
Well, I think there's a distinction between when I fell in love with Jane Austen and when I fell in love with Mr. Darcy. But I think I fell in love with Jane Austen when I was about 17, a schoolgirl in Leeds, and was like horrified by what I was being asked to read, which was sort of Tristram Shandy and Gulliver's Travels, and being told that it was funny. And then opened this book, and from the very first line, which we all know, I thought, this is brilliant. This is a woman writer who's actually still funny, and she was writing centuries ago. And it was so spunky and perceptive and funny and romantic, and a woman who was full of spirit and humour and principle and not afraid to stand up to bossy men. I just thought it was great, and it always stayed with me as a perfectly pitched voice that I wanted to kind of copy.
Did you imagine yourself as Elizabeth Bennet?
Yes, very much so. Elizabeth Bennet and Maria from The Sound of Music.
Ah.
Who I think are very similar in many ways, as are Mr. Darcy and Captain Von Trapp. But that's another story.
That is. That would be a great story, actually.
I'd like to mix them together.
Well, it could be the literary time travellers' wives and husbands. Could muffin them all up together.
That's a great idea. Yeah, well, I'm onto that.
You heard it here first, Liz.
Yeah. But,
Jill, what about you? When did you fall in love with Jane Austen?
Well, I fell in love with the novels at school when they first came into my life. My English teacher, I was an incredibly uncivilized child. And then I got this English teacher when I was 16 who'd done her thesis on Jane Austen. And she sort of used the novels of Austen as an instrument with which to civilize me somehow. Anyway, it kind of half worked as an experiment. But then I fell in love with her as a person when I was, you know, much later on, about 20 years later, when I read the letters, and I thought, oh, hello, I get you, you could be my mate. Her voice and her spirit and her concerns, actually, in the letters, which were all really about how annoying your mother is and whether that hat, you know, oh my God, I look a fright in that hat, that sort of thing. I just thought I really got on with her as a person. So it was a kind of long process.
So can you remember the first novel you read?
The first one, well, I had Northanger Abbey for O-level, and that's not, you know, I mean...
Like Northanger Abbey, I think it's a very bad...
Northanger Abbey. Whatever. And then...
Right, you know I'm the chair, do you? I had to ask you really difficult questions now.
Then along came Mansfield Park, then came Sense of Sensibility, and actually, it, you know, then reached a peak, a climax, really, with Pride and Prejudice.
Brilliant. And Kalika, did you study her at school, or you different education system maybe?
I didn't. So Jane Austen isn't necessarily assigned in school. Sometimes Pride and Prejudice is. But I happened across a paperback of Sense and Sensibility when I was about 12, I suppose. And I grew up in a house, we were always encouraged to read, but I started that and I just thought, this is the most phenomenal thing I've ever read. Why isn't every book this? So as soon as I finished that, which I think I skipped out on a piano lesson because I just couldn't put it down. So I'm sorry about that, Mom. But then I had to read everything. So next was Pride and Prejudice. And I still remember where I was when we have the chapter that Mr. Darcy crosses Mr. Wickham in the street. And, you know, there's just a fantastic plot twist that's about to come. So, yeah, I started, and then it has just remained with me for decades now.
And is... they're the same kind of moment of acknowledgement in young
American or Canadian or, you know, women when they come across Austen? Or were you special, as it were? You know, could you talk to friends saying, have you read this yet?
Absolutely. So my closest friend growing up, she lived two houses down the street. We watched the BBC Pride and Prejudice obsessively. And we would trade books back and forth. So I think that's one of the wonderful things about Austen. It just sort of, her writing transcends ages and countries and genders and everything. So yes, I absolutely had a good core group of friends that I could talk to Austen about.
Yeah, it's a lovely idea. Now, I mean, this particular talk is about how Jane Austen changed people's lives. And I have to own up here that Jane Austen did change my life, but not quite in the way that we're going to carry on talking about. In that it was my first relationship with Intelligence Squared, which was I was asked to do a debate against Jane Austen. Because often there is the idea that there's only one or two women who write. And so therefore, if you're pro-Jane Austen, you must be anti-Emily Bronte. I know. And if you're pro-Emily Bronte, you must be anti-Jane Austen. And I was on the Bronte team. And it was my biggest success because although Jane Austen still won, because there was a vote. She won by very little. I had almost swung the entire room by the end. So I'm very proud of that. But it's a very interesting point, actually, about the idea that it's got to be either or, rather than what about reading both of them. They're such different writers. Anyway, so that is my how Jane Austen changed my life, because obviously Intelligence Squared has been a very important part of my life since then. So that's how she changed my life. Helen, how did she change your... Well, we can imagine, but tell us how she changed your life.
Well, she changed my life because I stole her plot.
Yes.
So,
was it?
When I started writing Bridget Jones, it was just a series of anonymous columns in the Independent newspaper. And I didn't say it was me because I was trying to be a serious political journalist. And I thought they were really silly and no one would read them. But then they suddenly got some popularity to the point where my publisher said, why don't you make them into a book? But there was no plot, and I'm hopeless at plots. And at the same moment, the BBC's Pride and Prejudice, which you saw, was on the TV, and the streets were empty on Sunday night.
Yeah.
And everyone was going around growling, Mr. Darcy, Mr. Darcy. So I sort of morphed the columns into Pride and Prejudice and made this character, Mark Darcy, who was Mr. Darcy, and always ultimately Colin Firth as well, this kind of hybrid creature. And so
I just... I think he's ever been described as a hybrid creature. Colin Firth.
He's a mixture of Mr. Darcy and Mark Darcy and Colin Firth. But anyway, the columns became a book, and it was entirely based, plot-wise, and to a degree, character-wise, on Pride and Prejudice. So she completely changed my life.
And why did you know, or how did you have the instinct that it was an evergreen plot, that it would work for now? You know, 200 years and more has passed since Jane Austen died.
Well, I didn't really, and I don't think anyone really ever knows anything. I never thought that book would become anything. But actually, in hindsight, it is a pretty foolproof plot. And that's why it's been adapted. There's been 17, I think, film, TV adaptations at least. And those are just the ones that are Pride and Prejudice, not Pride and Prejudice, the zombie movie. It is. It's just an extremely solid plot and set of characters. And you have to work quite hard to muck it up.
Well, you didn't muck it up. It's absolutely extraordinary.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Jill changed your life. Is that too true? A bit strong? What do you think?
She probably has a bit, rather. I mean, I've come very late to this game. I didn't start writing novels till I was in my 50s. But I was writing a column and I got the boot and I was 51, and Navy employs a 51-year-old woman. So I thought, oh, well, I'd better write a novel then. And I thought, how do you do that? And because I'd written that biography of Jane Austen for children, it's quite annoying writing a short book because you have to know everything you need to know to write a long book and then choose what to leave out. And so I knew her basic principles, you know, and that when she herself had come to write a novel, had said, 3 or 4 families in a country village is the very thing to work on. And of course, she's right about that. Like, she's right about everything. It is the most perfect basis for a novel. It's the basis of EastEnders, it's the basis of Coronation Street. They're not country villages, but they're 3 or 4 families, cheap by jowl, dependent on one another. And we all know from our own lives, you know, once people start having children and their children have children, it throws up enough drama to keep us all on the edge of our seats until we don't know what's, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? All of what our friends' kids get up to and our own children get up to and so on. So there was that. And then 30 years ago, we bought this house, this vicarage in Berkshire, and I was told that there was a Jane Austen connection to it, which I kind of thought probably they all had vicarages in Berkshire because she was a vicar's daughter and, you know, that they'd go flitting around having tea and that's what they did. But in fact, the connection was with her sister, who had been engaged to the son of the vicar, and then he died. And it was all very heartbreaking and terrible. And she, that from that moment, just sort of donned black and said, that's it, I'm a spinster. And from she, Cassandra, owning her spinsterhood, it enabled Jane to become a spinster, to embrace her own spinsterhood. And Cassandra protected her throughout Jane's life until Jane died in Cassandra's arms. And she was the absolute midwife of the novels. And I became very Team Cassandra then when I discovered all of that. And it gave me the idea for Miss Austen about putting the case for her. And I'm now writing I wrote Godmersham Park, which is about Jane Austen's relationship with her niece's governess, which is all sort of true and vaguely documented. And I'm now writing another one about her niece when she was growing up. So it has given me
sort of in
material.
Fuel and nourishment, I suppose.
Enormous.
One of the things that is so interesting about the longevity of Jane Austen is, do you think she is misunderstood? That quite often people talk about, you know, their romance novels, but there's a lot more to all of the novels, really, than that. I mean, that's kind of the architecture in some respects, but it's not what the book is about only, is it?
No,
not at all. I mean, you know, there's only a few stories. There's sort of 6 or 10 basic stories, and the romantic plot is one of them. But what she hangs on it is so not chick-lit. And, you know, she often is, it's appalling, but she is sort of pushed into that
chick-lit sort of bonnet,
female-only area. But I think she once said she was writing on a little piece of ivory or something. She tells you this small story, as you say, about a small group of people, so sociologically and politically. She's also telling you about the war, about the position of women financially, and their plight if they haven't got enough money to exist without being married. She's so perceptive about people. And even, I think she was only 21 when she wrote Pride and Prejudice. She sets out her stall on people. You know, she'll say, "Vanity was the beginning and the end of Sir Walter Elliot's character. Mr. Darcy was clever. Mr. Collins was not a sensible man." She's very sort of clear and moral. She has these great comic characters. She has great comedy set pieces, which is why her books translate so well to movies. And she's really perceptive about human nature and also very kind and decent and moral. It's not a bitter voice. She is full of warmth and a lack of pretension and humour and sort of female solidarity. There's a huge amount about female friendship.
Absolutely.
In the books. So I think they stand up with anything out. I think she's a terrific, she's my favourite writer.
Yeah, that's not surprising one way or another.
Yeah, I owe her.
Yeah, big time. Yeah.
Jill. Yeah, I think the romantic fiction is very much her shop window, and she's got so many other things to say. The reason I like writing about her and Cassandra and is because I'm fascinated by the women of that time, their utter powerlessness. And Jane's novels are about the powerlessness of women, really. I think we read them all wrong, in a way. We read them from the comfort and the strength of our situation of being educated and being resourceful and so on. But when a contemporary reader would have started Pride and Prejudice, they would have seen, you know, the entailed property and the five daughters. That is your basic mother's nightmare. You know, they're reading a horror story. What on earth are they going to do with these five girls? We think it's a lark. And the BBC Pride and Prejudice, faultless, beautiful work of genius, it really, really undermines Mrs. Bennet, I think.
Who, in a way, is probably
Jane Austen's heroine. It's not Lizzie Bennet. It's Mrs. Bennet, who understands that those five girls are in serious jeopardy. And, you know, so Jane and Lizzie possibly could have been governesses. Those other three, they were off on the game if anything happened to their father. They really are about to fall through the floorboards of life, as is Anne Elliot, because Walter Elliot's got rid of her, you know, and Fanny Price has absolutely no social capital. These women are in danger, and they are rescued by their wits as well as by their menfolk. They are rescued, the men respond to what is good and great about those women, and they are saved. It's Mrs. Bennet's triumph is actually what Pride and Prejudice is about. And because Mr. Bennet was played by that really twinkly actor, and he's got those great lines, you know, some of the greatest lines in literature, we all think, "Oh, Mr. Bennet," and we all think, "She's so stupid." But actually, he's terrible. He's just, you know, sitting in the library, doesn't care about them, whether they live or die, can't be asked to go up the road to see the men in the big house. And he's just condemning them to death. So I think we don't understand that. And then she litters, apart from the sort of glossy heroines, she litters the text with people like Mrs. Smith in Emma, who's stuck in her bedsit, you know, with a servant calling once a day because it's all gone wrong. And Miss Bates, you know, who Emma laughs at, and really...
It can go wrong in a matter of...
Totally.
It can be fine, and then it's not Calico. See you.
Oh, no, I was going to say Miss Bennet as well. When you look at Mr. Bennet, he's functionally negligent. And then when you have the Bates as well, I think Austen's making a very interesting point. Yeah. You have Emma laughing at Miss Bates, and she doesn't sort of have that wit to contend with the other male characters. So that, you know, I think she's also maybe giving some sort of cautionary tale that if you don't have wit and you don't have education that you kind of seek out on your own, you will also be left behind.
I mean, for a woman, if you didn't get married and if your brother or any relative didn't want to keep you, you had these options. You had becoming a governess. Well, not everybody was educated or you know, equipped to be a governess. Then there was being companion to an elderly lady. Nightmare. And not only that, short-term occupation, because then they died. And then after that, it was just prostitution. And I did an event with a Regency historian a couple of years ago who said that in 1810, the prostitute population of London was 800,000, you know, and the population of London wasn't that big. And a lot of these, you know, a lot of, they were eight-year-old girls. They were just people who weren't being protected by men.
Well, yes, because this, I mean, this is all the period of time before Caroline Norton and those significant, you know, the Custody of Infants Act, the Married Women's Property Act, where women started to have any sort of agency and power over things. But one of the interesting things is that it was one of those moments of there not being enough men to go round anyway. It's like after the First World War. So I think it's something like only 30% of women were actually married. So there's often within both the novels and Jane's life, the idea that it was exceptional that she was unmarried and lived with her sister. But actually that was more likely than not, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that that has perhaps contributed to this sort of idea, which was still lingering when I started writing Bridget, that if a woman is single, there's been some horrible mistake. And, you know, and she is sort of, there are shelves and spinning wheels and shades of Miss Havisham hanging around. And you're going to end up dying alone and being found 3 weeks later, half eaten by an Alsatian.
Yes.
And, you know, I think as Jewel has pointed out, that it, you know, you said that getting married in Jane Austen's day was a bit of a death sentence because you could end up having 11 children and people often died in childbirth.
If you got married at 17, then you had, what, 23 pregnancies in you? If you got married at 17 and your husband liked you, then you would be in pig for the rest of your days. And of all of her sisters-in-law, they all copped it in childbirth on the 8th, the 9th and the 11th babies, that they died. And that was it was a death sentence. So you did have to think several times about whether to accept the person, in that you barely knew him anyway.
And especially if he was a ghastly creep like Mr. Collins in...
Exactly.
Mr. Collins.
Mr. Collins and Wickham, you know, the sort of... The
Donald Cleaver,
the sexy bastard that everyone falls for, you know. They did have to think twice.
But they didn't know them very well. They'd dance with them a few times. Mm-hmm. They'd be on their own when they were proposed to. And then they were carted off. You know, you went off to live where your husband lived. So their mother would become your mother and their house would be your house. It was quite a big deal, really.
It's a scandal.
In terms of the novels themselves and why they have this incredibly enduring appeal, and we're going to talk in a moment to Kalika about the wonderful books that are part of the Book Week, and why people are still so passionate about Jane Austen and all of her work. There is just something that is... she is both utterly of her time and utterly bigger than any particular time. That's right, isn't it? In terms of the way that she writes her stories and her plot. So what is it that makes a relatively innocent, but a woman who lived quite a confined life within the south of England for the most part, a universal voice? What is it?
I think when she wrote, she was in her absolute moment in terms of her voice and her understanding of human nature, of what exactly was going on around her and where everyone fitted and what was funny about it. And I think that is what has endured alongside her perfect plotting. She wrote books that turned the pages, but it was that understanding of human nature. And that is what I'm always very against the divide between fiction and literary fiction. You know, literary fiction can sometimes be the thing where you read the same paragraph over and over again and don't remember that you've read it. And, you know, if you go to the other end of popular fiction, it has no meaning. But she married the two, and she managed to make stories where you wanted to know what happened next. But it was the depths of understanding of human nature and human life and people and the world that elevated it above that.
Because humour is one of the things that dates most quickly.
Humour just weirdly does. I mean, even my children, the things that they look at on YouTube, they only want the 10 funniest seconds. Sometimes I remember making them watch things I used to think were funny, sitcoms and Monty Python, they're just not funny anymore. And, you know, a lot of old comic novels don't stand the test of time, but she does. And that's kind of magical. They're good jokes.
Yeah, yeah. Jill, you've used the real life, as it were, as your inspiration. Is that because you felt that it was important to put the woman more visibly centre stage, as opposed to the adaptations and the, you know, the we're never watching Jane when we're watching a Pride and Prejudice or an Emma or a Sense and Sensibility, but there is always somehow the idea that she's lurking in the background.
Yes, I mean, my degree was in history rather than English, and I do remember sort of getting to the end of the 3 years and thinking, goodness me, they were all men. You know, that entire 3 years was about what men had done and what men had said and what men had... And I had this enormous interest in women's lives, which have been largely unrecorded, and so we know so little about them. And what I love about the novels is what a social record they are of what women's lives were like. And we don't have fantastic diaries of women in the 19th century. They didn't have time to write them, that's why. And anyway, nobody would have treasured them in the way, you know, and brought them down to us through the generations, the way they have their grandfathers. And so those novels are a fantastic, I think, original source on what it was like to be a woman, a domestic woman, a certain sort of comfort of a certain class in a certain area. And so writing about her gives me that sort of canvas to explore that. And then to honour the style of her and so on. But their stories, I find, they are the most extraordinary family. You know, this Mr. Austin was just a vicar in Hampshire, but he was extraordinary. He was an orphan and a genius. I mean, he had no money at all. And then he went to Oxford and was the greatest classicist of his generation. And then he married this woman and they went off to be to this parish in Steventon, and they had 8 children, and they were amazing. They were amazing children, and nobody even knew that Jane was the best of them. You know, certainly the eldest son, who thought he was the literary top dog, and sort of, he thought he was the big. But there were 2 admirals. You know, one fought at Trafalgar. They were a really astonishing bunch. And then not Jane and Cassandra, but all the brothers went on to have thousands of nieces and nephews. If you like a family saga, which I do, you know, something like the Caslet Chronicles, something like that, the best thing ever, then the Austens are marvellous because it's all there. It's absolutely all there, what the human comedy and drama and tragedy.
Do you wish that her sister had loved her less and thought of the future more and hadn't burnt so many of the letters?
No, because everything would be different. If we thought that, you know, if... So Cassandra outlived Jane and before her own death sat down with the thousands and thousands of letters they'd exchanged and burnt all of Cassandra's to Jane, and then burnt all but 160 of Jane's to Cassandra. And the biographers loathe her for that because of all of the gaps it's left in her history. But, you know... She was not, Jane was not a person who would have liked her diaries to be discovered and serialised in the Daily Mail. That really wasn't. She was an absolute, it's so interesting to encounter her in this awful world that we live in where people want to be famous for nothing, you know, for just going on telly in a bikini for 6 weeks, and that makes them famous. And that's just, and Jane was writing the greatest novels in the English language, and she didn't want anybody to know. There was this woman in the village called Miss Ben, poor Miss Ben, she was always called, who was blind. So they had to take it in turns to go and read her. And in 1815, when it was the sort of Bridget Jones of the summer, Miss Ben said she wanted this read to her, Pride and Prejudice. And she actually had the author of Pride and Prejudice reading it to her and saying,
teachers, you know. I don't think that bit's very funny. It's all very overrated, that sort of thing.
And she kept it buttoned because she wouldn't tell a soul. Her nieces and nephews didn't know she'd written it. So it wasn't until after she died that anybody knew that that timid little woman in Hampshire was who did it. So it's completely in keeping for us not to know how infuriated she was by her sister-in-law Mary, or how depressed she was that she wanted to die. You know, that's really not what...
Complete separation of the work and the person.
Yes,
I mean, it's
none of our business.
I mean, it's one of the things. I mean, it's not unusual at that time that books appeared without the author's name on the frontispiece anyway. So four of the novels were published without a name on them, although after Sense and Sensibility, which had been successful, it had by the author of Sense and Sensibility, and then Northanger Abbey, I believe, and Persuasion, was it, that was published posthumously.
Yeah, they were published together.
Yeah, as a set. So Kalika, as an expert here, and a Jane Austen lover as well, her reputation during her lifetime, as Jill and Helen have been saying, nobody really knew her, and the books weren't successful, and she was quite frustrated by that. So what happened to make her go from being, you know, the lady sitting in Hampshire scribbling away to being a superstar?
It's sort of a rocky journey, I suppose, in some ways, that has some ups and downs. So, as you say, during her lifetime, there were relatively few reviews of her novels. They weren't unfavorable, but she wasn't wildly successful like her male peers. And then about 50 years after her death, there was a biography written of her by a nephew, and that sort of helped bump her popularity up again. So there was interest towards the end of the Victorian period. It wasn't really until about 1920 that there was a new critical edition of Jane Austen, and that was the first time that there was this real scholarly attention around her writing.
Why did that happen? Why was there a scholarly edition then? I'm fascinated.
Yeah, that's a great question. So as Jill has alluded to, there's very little original manuscript material that remained. In the way books were published at the time, there were often a lot of liberties that were taken by the editor, the person that was setting the type. And so I think that by that point, especially sort of surrounding World War I, when Jane's popularity sort of surged again, so her works were actually assigned to soldiers who had experienced PTSD related to the war, who were in the trenches. So there was kind of this elite group of people who were always interested in Austen and who were always reading her. So I think from that, then there became a more sort of general popularity, and then that led to the scholarly edition. So it's not that she was ever completely off the scene, as it were, but then certainly by the, you know, 1950s or so, there was a lot more critical attention that was paid, a lot more scholarly attention. People were writing theses on Austen. And then certainly in the 90s, I think the BBC Pride and Prejudice did not hurt. I think
the wet shirt.
I think that in conjunction with Emma Thompson's Sense and Sensibility, suddenly Jane Austen was on bestseller lists again and just had this incredible resurgence of popularity. And I think in a sort of scholarly capacity, now people are doing much more work trying to sort of figure out what Jane Austen was reading, what performances was she seeing, and how does this kind of intertextual life of hers work as well. And in conjunction with that, the demand for her books has also skyrocketed. So a first edition that would have sold, you know, maybe 30 years ago, now is worth two or three times as much, or maybe more in some instances. Certainly at the time that she was published, something like Sense and Sensibility, which was her first published work, there were only 750 copies of the first edition, and they were published in boards that you were meant to buy it and then have it rebound so it matched the style of your library. So those boards were meant to be ephemeral. And so if you can find something in the original publisher's boards, that's absolutely as close as you can get to the original publication state, and I think arguably as close as you can get to Austen. So we have Sense and Sensibility that was about 750. Then we have Pride and Prejudice, and that really wasn't much more. So it's closer to 1,000, and now that's, you know, by far and away everybody's favorite. So you can imagine the sort of demand to find a first edition of Pride and Prejudice full stop, but also one in the publisher's boards. Then Mansfield Park, which sold the best during Austin's lifetime, and I think now maybe is read the least. That might be a controversial statement, but I think that could be true.
There's a lot about the Enclosures Act in it, possibly a little bit of its time.
Exactly. Trying to sell that to undergraduates now is a little bit more difficult. But that is astonishingly rare. So finding that in the original publisher's boards, I think only two copies have come up in the last 70 years or so. So I think along with our more sort of scholarly appreciation for Jane Austen, the demand for these books has just skyrocketed because we really do see them as treasures. We see them as close as we can get to the author. And if you love Jane Austen, if her prose have sort of transformed your life, that is absolutely the thing that you want to have.
And we've got on the screen, you've brought some books with you.
I have, yes.
Are these in the sale?
These are in the December sale.
In the December sale.
Yes.
So can you just talk us through a little bit about what we have? So that, because there are things called the association copy, and there are different types of copies. What do those things mean?
Absolutely. So the association copy, it's the 1791 edition of Disraeli's Curiosities of Literature. So that obviously was not written by Austen, but what's extraordinary about it is that it's signed by her on the title page. So there are very few books that we know of that were owned by Austen. I think, again, as Jill has suggested, there's just very little evidence of her life. So we know that there are books that she gave to nieces and to her brother, and those are more sorts of presentation copies. I think this is particularly extraordinary because it's a book about literature that she probably owned quite early in her life. And this is something that she cared enough about to write her own name in. So this is truly an extraordinary survival, and we are just absolutely thrilled to have it alongside these other first editions, which in general, having first editions of all of her published works together in one sale, I think hasn't happened in, you know, probably decades maybe. It's really extraordinary to see them all together.
And do you see, as time goes on, you know, Bridget Jones' Diary, one of the 10 novels of the 20th century, according to go. That's just so fantastic. But do you all feel that her enduring appeal will just continue, that regardless of what literary movements are out there, what people are doing in the world and all of the rest of it, that there will still be some corner of all of our hearts that will always belong to Jane Austen?
And I think it's quite interesting because you actually don't really know. And I think it's interesting the number of writers that didn't know how successful their work was going to be. Like, it's a really brilliant book called Hemingway on Writing, little bits of his letters, and he's always writing to Scott Fitzgerald to try and cheer him up about how meaning the reviewers were. Now, no one liked his books. Everyone thought The Great Gatsby was rubbish and Tender in the Night was rubbish. And then look what happened. They're still huge, but there is a sort of zeitgeisty thing. There is something you can't quite put your finger on. Like when I wrote those Bridget columns, I had no idea that it was going to become popular. And lots of other people were writing the same sort of thing at the same time. So there will be a reason why this century and the end of the last century was when Jane Austen became hugely popular. Maybe it was something to do with what has been going on with women at the moment. Maybe it's that. Maybe the next century, it won't be that. Maybe there won't even be books anymore. You know, I'm sorry, but we have to face the fact that, you know, AI, things are changing the way young people read. I mean, what do they actually read? Do they read books or do they watch things? But storytelling and creativity is like water. It finds a path. So the answer is we really don't know. But at the moment, I'd love to know how many books she sold. Do you know? I mean, does anyone know?
There are some records. So Sense and Sensibility sold relatively well. Pride and Prejudice, I think, sold out within a year. And so there was a second edition issued. Mansfield Park sold very well. Emma did not, which is interesting because I think now Emma is viewed as...
Do you think that's less sympathetic as a heroine?
I think that's absolutely true, which we know that she said that she was going to create a heroine which nobody but herself would like much. And I think in some ways it's because it's the heroine who maybe most resembles her and her snarky attitudes.
Oh, that's you. Well, I always thought she was Lizzie Bennet. But I mean, do you know how many books she's sold altogether in the world ever?
Ever.
There are lists. Yeah. Really. Whether they are in any way accurate. The only one I can tell you is that the biggest selling author in world history is a woman, but it's Agatha Christie.
Yes.
Yes. And estimates vary between 2 billion and 4 billion, which seems to be quite a wide margin for error. But anyway, she wins. But there are lists, and Jane Austen is in those lists. But there's a little bit of sucking it and see, isn't there? Because...
But Austen is like Agatha Christie's, is the same in that their works are perfectly tailored to movies and TV, and that's why really that she has had this enormous burst in the last 50 years and could go on forever, because in fact they're just perfect films.
I'm about to use a word that I really, really dislike, but it's...
We'll forgive you.
Thank you. It's that terrible word, relatable.
Yes.
But is there an element of the fact that these are stories that anybody could be in?
Yes.
You know, they're not set on a spaceship or going into battle or, you know... They are everybody.
Well, that's what her great bitterness in her life was. She had the great misfortune to be writing at the same time as Walter Scott, who couldn't, you know, they weren't wheelbarrows big enough for as much money as he was bringing home every afternoon. He was so popular, it was ridiculous. But he said, and here's, his huge epic stories, enormously big canvases. But he himself said when he reviewed Emma, he said, I can do the big bow wow as well as anyone, but she is the one who does the little piece of ivory thing. And I think that's so brilliant, the big bow wow, because it's the big bow wow that doesn't last, in fact. And it's stories about, God, your mother's annoying and the next door neighbour's really nosy and I really fancy that bloke up the road. That is the universality of her, and it is the actually tiny, tininess of her universe that makes her so enduring.
I think what's quite interesting there is when you ask that question, could anyone be in it? What about men? You know, there's so many books talking about Hemingway. Again, I don't quite know why, but his...
Is this your next project?
Copy.
I quite like that, actually.
Yeah, not my own. His women are very cardboard cutout-ish. And I don't know how much men would identify with Mr. Darcy. You know, what is actually going on in his head? I always remember when I was talking to Andrew Davis, who adapted the Pride and Prejudice for the BBC in 1995. His whole theory was that Mr. Darcy had the most enormous sex drive, which explained all his behaviour with Elizabeth Bennet, that he was just overcome with desire. And that's where there were all those mad scenes when he march into the room and just walk around and not say anything, so he couldn't think about anything else.
Risk sitting it out, I see.
But you know, she looks at men and gives them a label. A sensible man, not a sensible man, vain, kind, clever, otherwise. But I don't know how much she actually gets into their heads. But as a woman, you could totally always be one of the women in those books. I think that's a distinction there.
Yeah. Well, I think if Jane Austen were here, she would probably be quiet at the back and not say who she was. But the fact that we are sitting here, you know, more than 200 years after she died, talking about these characters as if we know them, is a testament to the quite extraordinary power of those novels, I think. We have come to the end of our event, I'm afraid, but it has been a complete joy to listen to you all and to hear your different views. And there we do come up and look at the books. But could you please join me in giving a huge round of applause for Helen Fielding, for Jill Hornby, and for Kanika Sands. And just to say, if you'd like to know more about what is coming up on Sotheby's, I think we've got some on the screen. The Fine Books and Manuscripts auction will take place in New York on the 22nd of November at 10 a.m. EST.
And included in that is each of Jane Austen's finished novels, as you've said, Austen's own copy of the Isaac Disraeli's Curiosities of Literature, which we saw up on the screen, signed by her on the title page, first editions, yes, of each of the Bronte sisters' finished novels. Yes, I'm in. A presentation copy of Charles Dickens's Great Expectations, which we have talked about before, and wonderfully, Wilkie Collins' The Moonstone in the original cloth, and many, many other works. And you can go online and I'm sure see the whole thing. And if you are here in the galleries, this is the Leslie and Joanna Garfield collection, Celebration of David Hockney. And the live auction for this will take place here in London on the 15th of November at 2 p.m. GMT. So you can scan everything on your card if you've got a QR code on your printed card on your seat. So that will give you all the information you need. But once again, thanks to you for being such a wonderful and warm audience and for your questions. To Intelligence Squared and to Sotheby's for making these fantastic coming together of readers and writers so pleasurable. And again, this extraordinary panel, Kalika, Jill and Helen.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue, featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.